Thanks, Riley. Good evening to everybody. We appreciate your being with us on this Lord's Day evening. I'm in good shape already. I've got my Bible upside down. Sorry about that. We welcome you to our meeting, and we appreciate your presence if you're a guest with us tonight. And we hope everybody will help us remember the families this week who are beloved to us, who have challenges, special challenges to go through, Pat and her family, for example, tomorrow. Hope that you can help us to be with them and support them. We've been thinking about some of the great lessons in the minor prophets, the books of the Old Testament, which are smaller but have great lessons and ever relevant lessons, especially when we think about what goes on in a culture or a society, and then how God deals with the nations of the world. Tonight we're thinking about Obadiah, a little book of the Old Testament, but one which has a message that's needed. I want you to think about two boys, twins, though not identical, who were born to a set of parents who had long prayed for the blessing of children. When they were born, one had to hold of the other one's heel, a foreboding of the struggle that would go on between them over time. As life developed, one became a favorite of his father, and the other was the favorite of their mother. And when it came time for the inheritance to be passed along, the blessing, which included a promise from God, one sold it for one meal, because that's what he wanted right at that moment, and consequences were not considered. The other one worked with a bit of deceit in order to gain that inheritance. And though he was a man who had innumerable weaknesses, he had one great strength, and it was the ability to appreciate the presence of holiness when he found himself in that presence, and the ability to treasure that promise that we had that we mentioned a few moments ago. The other boy, the one who sold his inheritance for the one meal, becomes, in the New Testament, referred to as a man who was irreligious, a man who was common, or a man who had no regard, really, a profane man who had no regard for what was holy. And he becomes a figure for the inability to be sensitive to the things of God and to give any consideration to who or what comes after him. Both of these boys became fathers of nations, and the struggle that went on between them was only a seed sown in the life of each nation. And the terrible story of inhumanity which followed in the wake of that is really the subject of the little book of Obadiah. Obadiah is unknown anywhere other than in the first verse of this one little book. His name means a servant of the Lord. His father's name is not mentioned, nor is any place of birth assigned to him. We have no idea where he lived, but I think the suspicion is probably Jerusalem, or at least in that area. He's the author of the shortest book in the Old Testament. It's called A Vision. Nahum is another book, another of the books that begins in this way. Obadiah is one of six Old Testament prophets with no explanation of the occasion of the vision. He's one of seven who is not quoted in the New Testament, and perhaps not even echoed, although I find one place where I think maybe it is. What makes it different is it's an oracle against a foreign nation. rather than it being a denunciation of any sin in Judah or a correction of any failure among God's covenant people. That makes it interesting. How would a prophet of Judah speak a word to someone other than to his people? How would the God of Jacob deal with some other nation? That's what we have to think about. You see, this little letter is concerning Edom, verse 1 says. Thus says the Lord God concerning Edom. The Edomites were the descendants of Esau, that one boy I was mentioning at the beginning who had no respect for what was holy. Genesis 26, verses 1 and 8 and 9 tell us that Edom descended from Esau. Edom, in the time of the prophets writing this letter, was a country, a land that God had given to the descendants of Esau. It was a strip of mountainous land that was south of the Dead Sea. And it had parts of the land which rose to the level of 5,000 feet above sea level. And the rugged territory caused there to be heights which could only be approached through small passes, which therefore were easily defended and which could leave a people with the feeling of invincibility, as if they were so protected that nobody could possibly get to them. This region is also frequently called in the Old Testament Seir, S-E-I-R, which is the reference to the tallest of the mountain ranges that I just mentioned. The main cities were Selah, Teman, which was became a reference to the southern part of Edom, and then a city, Bozrah, which this latter comes to be Petra later. You've seen, most likely, if you've seen any picture of biblical archaeology, you've seen some kind of a picture of Petra, like a city carved into the face of huge limestone cliffs, very detailed architecture, amazing work, with a small way to get through it, through a narrow pass. The people who lived there felt like they were surrounded by the works of their own glory. And it certainly, even now, even though there's nothing there but their stone works, is an impressive thing even to see a picture of, and I'm sure much less to stand there and look up at it. This easily defended area was also very rich in resources, maybe partly because they were a secure situation, but also because there was a passage through the area from the Gulf down to the south, on back up to the Fertile Crescent, which was referred to as the King's Highway. Caravans would pass through carrying their goods, and if you lived there close by and you were able to be blessed, have access to all the goods that could go and come, and if you had no enemies that could approach you through the because of the geography, then you can see how you could become proud and complacent and unconcerned about right or wrong or other people or even your own neighbors. In a sense, the Edomites were brothers to Israel. Verse 10 of this letter, for example, we'll use that as the sort of the launching point of the problem that this little book addresses, and maybe a point in it for us to stop for a minute and describe how we got from those two boys that I mentioned to start with to how things are now when this letter is written, somewhere around 550 B.C., most likely. Jacob, or we know him better as Israel, Jacob's conflict with Esau, and the resulting history of conflict between their ancestors, the Israelites and the Edomites, is something that really you begin the story of in Genesis chapter 25. It grows more deep and obvious in Numbers chapter 20. And it helps, I think, to have in mind here the picture that's painted in Deuteronomy chapter 2, where you have the same event from Moses' perspective. The Israelites wanted to pass through on their way through the wilderness. They wanted to use the king's highway and to pass through Edom in order to access the promised land without the difficult terrain and the struggle of the years and the presence of enemies. God told Moses in Deuteronomy chapter 2, beginning at verse 5, I've given this land to the Edomites. I don't want you Israelites to do anything that would threaten that. It's theirs by right. And so Moses and the Israelites asked the Edomites for passageway through the land. We want to pass through. We won't bother your vineyards. We won't trouble your flocks. We won't take anything from you. We'll pay our way for our passage and all of that. And the Edomites absolutely refused. And in Numbers 20, they threatened to come out with their swords to prevent or to fight against the Israelites and to inflict great damage upon them. Time went along, and Israel, after all the years, entered the promised land, and then the years go by, and David becomes king. In 2 Samuel 8 and verse 14, the Edomites are conquered by David, and they live subject to the rule of their brothers again, the Edomites do. And you think about how this Jacob had been promised by God that the younger brother, or the older brother, would serve the younger brother. And that turned out to be true when David conquered the Edomites and ruled over them. Israel did for a long time. Finally, the Edomites revolt against Israel. In 2 Kings 8 and verses 20 through 22, their revolt was successful. The people of Israel were not able to conquer them again. And when 2 Kings was written, it says that the Edomites were continuing in revolt to this day. And I'm sure that increased the feeling of bitterness that existed between the two. That leads us to what is the situation in Obadiah. We sort of read over it last time when we were reading Amos, and you might get a picture of this in Amos 1 in verses 11 and 12. Notice this. For three transgressions of Edom, and for four I will not revoke the punishment. Because he pursued his brother with the sword and cast off all pity, and his anger tore perpetually, and he kept his wrath forever, so I will send the fire upon Teman, and it shall devour the strongholds of Bozrah. The idea is that not only had Edom threatened Israel with a sword when they wanted passage through, but that anger had kept on, and it has caused, when we come on the scene in this little book here, it has caused a situation in which God sends Obadiah to rebuke. What has happened is that when the Babylonians come against Jerusalem and Judah, the Edomites take the side of the Babylonians instead of the side of their brothers. And when tragedy is befalling the Israelites, instead of the Edomites feeling like, oh my, this could happen to us too, instead they are so overcome with joy at the fall of their brothers that they can't even reconsider their proud situation and cope with the possibility that they might come under attack. The feeling of the Israelites because of this is obvious. In Psalm 137 at verse 7, it becomes a part of a song to God from Israel. Remember, O Lord, against the Edomites, the day of Jerusalem, how they said, lay it bare, down to its foundations. They've become like cheerleaders to the Babylonians here. And the people of Jerusalem have heard this, and it's stuck in their memory as well. And the hard feelings between them is palpable. Now, by the time of Malachi chapter 1 and verse 2, the Edomites have suffered a defeat themselves, and it's the defeat that this little book predicts. The Edomites are destroyed. And by the time of Jesus in the New Testament, the people known as the Nabataeans have taken over this territory, and it's largely become known as Edomia. The Herod family, the notorious Herod family, that are key characters, evil characters, most often in the New Testament, were Edomites. They were from Edomia here. So that's sort of the background to this. Now, a little bit quickly about the situation. The heart of this little book is verses 10 through 14. And I'd like you to notice here what happens in this passage. We'll just describe it as we go along. Because of the violence done to your brother Jacob, shame shall cover you, and you shall be cut off forever. Now, what kind of violence done to their brother Jacob? On the day that you stood aloof, and I'm told that the Hebrew word used here means to stand on the other side. And a lot of people, a lot of the writers will draw a parallel between the priest and the Levite in the story of the Good Samaritan, and how when the man is beaten and robbed and left for dead, they pass by on the other side. In other words, the Edomites are being condemned here for having not only approved of what happened, but kept themselves separate from it, not getting involved and lending any help or any hand. You stood aloof on the day that strangers carried off his, that is, your brother's wealth, and foreigners entered his gates and cast lot for Jerusalem. You were like one of them. Now, the idea is the Babylonians invaded the city and treated the heritage of God as if it were merchandise to gamble over, to cast lots over. And the Edomites, the brothers, just watch, apparently, with gladness. Verse 12 now says, "But do not gloat over the day of your brother and the day of his misfortune. Do not rejoice over the people of Judah in the day of their ruin. Do not boast in the day of distress." Look at what a common human thing here this is. When you have ill will toward another person or another people, you may not go do violence to them yourself, but your ill will causes you to gloat over any misfortune or to rejoice over any fall or failure that ruins them, and then to boast as if because it hasn't happened to you right then, you're better than they are. It's not a quality for us to feel very proud of, but I'm afraid it's a fairly common human characteristic. Do not enter the gate of my people in the day of their calamity. Do not gloat over his disaster in the day of his calamity. Do not loot his wealth in the day of his calamity. Do not stand at the crossroads to cut off his fugitives. Do not hand over his survivors in the day of distress. You put all that together and you can see what's happened. The Babylonians have come up against Jerusalem, and even though God was using the Babylonians to punish Jerusalem, he still expected people like the brothers of the Edomites to have a feel for them. But what the Edomites have done is to first feel aloof, second rejoice, third, loot the city themselves, taking whatever the Babylonians left and let them take. Cutting off, standing at the crossroads to cut off the ones who've survived and are trying to run away, and then handing them back over to be captives to the Babylonian. Now, if you wonder what I mean by inhumanity, that's the kind of thing I'm talking about. What kind of a heart do you have? To behave that way toward the people who are closest to you, that you have most in common with. If we lose the ability to feel compassion where there is violence, to be involved where there is injustice, to try to realize what we would feel like if we were going through that, then we've robbed ourselves of civilization in a very real way. Edom has been inhuman. Is that a word? He's been unhuman to Israel in this case, and the reason for it is identified by the prophet in verse 3 of this little book, and I think this is a key statement. So I'd like you to consider it. The prophet says to Edom, "The pride of your heart has deceived you, you who live in the clefts of the rock in your lofty dwelling, who say in your heart, 'Who will bring me down to the ground?'" You can kind of see the attitude here. We live in prosperity. We live in a place which is naturally and geographically easily defended. Therefore, we feel secure. Therefore, we feel better than others who are being overcome. And we don't realize that other nations have fallen in a similar situation. And that kind of brings, you notice the question at the end of verse 3 is left hanging. Who will bring me to the ground? Well, God answers in verse 4. Though you soar aloft like the eagle, though your nest is set among the stars, from there I will bring you down. And you got to looking up at the big cliffs like later Petra was carved into, you got to see. You got to read it that way, like an eagle on his nest up there. I'll bring you down. And so the message of this book is largely the explanation of that one statement in verse 4. The pride of Edom has been shown in its behavior toward Jerusalem and Judah in its day of need, and God will correct their behavior by dealing with their pride. And notice in the rest of this book the principles that are at stake here. Verse 15 is one of them. "For the day of the Lord is near upon all the nations. As you have done, it shall be done to you. Your deed shall return on your own head." We recognize that principle, I think, pretty commonly in the New Testament, and this is the one statement that I think is echoed in the New Testament in Galatians 6. We often teach that whatever a man sows, that's what he also reaps. And that this is the application of that principle in a corporate way to nations or to populations. It never happens immediately, and it never happens quickly. It's hard for one generation to see, and yet this is the way the prophet said God deals with the nations. And there are different, there are ways in this book in which he pictures it taking place. He says in verse 16, "For as you have drunk on my holy mountain, so all the nations shall drink continually." And this is usually, drinking a cup is usually referring to the receiving the wrath of the judgment of God. "They shall drink and swallow and shall be as though they had never been." That's a kind of a sobering statement, isn't it? "Shall be as they had never been." Now, in this book, what Obadiah says is that the descendants of Esau will have a different experience than the descendants of Jacob have had. The Israelites have been invaded and they've been judged, but there's been a few of them left, and these few God will turn into a nation and make something of them. What he says, however, the Edomites is there won't be anything left. They come to nothing. There's not something to make something else out of here. In verse 17, you see the point that none of them escape. In Mount Zion, there shall be those who escape, and it shall be holy, and the house of Jacob shall possess their own possessions. On the other hand, look back with me a little earlier in the book at what happens to Edom, verses 5 and following. The Lord says to the Edomites, "If thieves come to you, if plunderers come by night," how they've been destroyed, would they not steal only enough for themselves?" In other words, the thief, if he were to come through, would leave a little stuff. There'd still be something left. He'd take what he wanted and he'd leave you the rest. "If the grape gatherers came to you, would they not leave gleanings?" Wouldn't there be a few that they didn't see that you could go through and pick for yourself? But how Esau has been pillaged, his treasures sought out. "All your allies have driven you to your border. Those at peace with you have deceived you. They've prevailed against you. Those who eat your bread," that's your allies, those who have a covenant with you, "have set a trap for you. You have no understanding." And then the point made, verses 8 and 9. "Will I not on that day, declares the Lord, destroy the wise men out of Edom, and understanding out of Mount Esau? And your mighty men shall be dismayed, O Teman. Oh, that every man from Mount Esau, so that every man from Mount Esau will be cut off by slaughter." It's a picture of judgment against inhumanity. In Jeremiah 9, in verse 23, one of the great statements of the Old Testament, the prophet taught that a wise man should not glory in his wisdom, and a mighty man should not glory in his might, and a rich man should not glory in his riches. And what you have in verses 8 and 9 of Obadiah is the exposing of the failure of those three retreats for human standing and security. No wisdom, no might, no riches, all of it wiped out. That's the ultimate end of inhumanity, and that's the reason I mention here the incurable expression of irreligion. It's what inhumanity is. All right, just real quickly, notice verse 21, which leads up finally to the day when the kingdom shall be the Lord's. And that, of course, is the great hope of the Old Testament, and it's what gets fulfilled under the work of Christ. Here are three applications I'd like to leave with us tonight. First, the problem of confident pride may be the most important and most basic source of inhumanity. The problem of confident pride. Nobody can do anything to us. We're too rich, too smart, and too powerful. That was false then, and it still is. Second, the fact that the lack of brotherly kindness is a tragedy of all tragedies. The Edomites, who feel no pain for their brother's suffering, who feel no connection with their neighbors, who recognize no investment of themselves into their next door kinfolks. That can't go on without there being consequences to it, either immediately and practically or in the longer term. And then thirdly, you have to recognize here the harvest of cruelty and bitterness. That which destroys individual lives, destroys a society's life as well. Cruelty and bitterness is the expression of a lack of respect for God in human experience. And there's not an answer to it that I can recognize anywhere in human ingenuity or human effort or human spending. There's no way to make a cruel and inhumane and bitter person treat his neighbor right. We have to get back before all of that and ask what being responsible to God means in our lives. We have to have a respect for holy things that causes us to see all other things in a certain way. And that's what the gospel eventually, of course, calls all of us to do. And one of the reasons we're trying to read the minor prophets is just to recognize that however much we may say this to ourselves, we are not people who have just come along at a certain age in the history of the world who have nothing in common at all with anybody who's ever lived or with generations who will live later on. We're like they were. The same problems bring the same outcomes. We need to change the seed that we're sowing. We need to do it as individuals, but we need to do it as a culture as well. And that's what I think about when I read this book. I thank the Lord for the coming of Christ, for His ministry and for His death and His resurrection, and then the offer of life in Him. Maybe that you're here tonight and you've been thinking about your own obedience to the gospel. If we can help you, we would take great joy in so doing this evening if you'd come and let us know that that's your desire.